I'm Chris Benda, and I'd like to welcome you to what I hope is the first in a series of conversations about recent or forthcoming publications by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. Today I'll be talking with Douglas Knight, the Drusilla Moore Buffington Professor of Hebrew Bible and Professor of Jewish Studies, about his forthcoming book, Law, Power, and Justice in Ancient Israel. Doug, thanks for being willing to be part of this interview.
Happy to do it.
Great. I'd like to start by reading something from a recent book on everyday law in biblical Israel. The authors write that their book is, quote, concerned with the texts of the Bible within the context of ancient Israelite law. The Bible is evidence for the practice and theory of law in the society that engendered it, unquote. How is this similar or different from what you're doing in your book?
I think it will be quite a bit different. It's my starting point is not the Bible at all. It's not that I'm not taking it into consideration, but I'm much more interested in trying to understand how law could have emerged and functioned in society. Some of that then will be retained in the biblical text, but it's not. I'm not really interested in trying to exegete the texts of the laws. They're only one of many, of several sources of the material that I'm looking at.
Okay. So before we get into discussing more particulars about your book, I just wanted to kind of get a clarification on what you mean by law. When you talk about law, how do you define it?
It's one of these situations where it's something that we all are familiar with, talk about, never really stop to define. And it's some of the discussions that have gone on in the spheres of legal studies, as I understand them, have focused on a number of different aspects of law. In one sense, law is something that the legislators enact. What do we do in a context where there is not a legislative body, such as would have been the case in ancient Israel or most any other pre-modern traditional society, if you will? In other instances, theoreticians have said law is what judges decree. That is to say, the judges then will take the store of existing laws or pronouncements and then apply them. So a law then is what, in fact, gets applied and enforced. That could work for ancient Israel, except the system of laws, that system of judges that they had in ancient Israel was probably pretty much run by the king's court, and there could have been a system of judges, elders, in other contexts, but we really don't know specifically how they functioned and what they would have, how they would have ruled. Another possibility is that law is not just something enacted by the legislature or ruled by a judge, but is decreed by a leader, such as a totalitarian leader. That would then have had the function or the power of law, but it comes from the top down, and it probably applies only to what is of interest to the emperor or the king in that case. So it's rather it's tilted in one direction, obviously. Now if unless we feel bound to any one of those three types of law, I think that another angle to it, and this is what I've been taking, is to cast the net much more broadly and to look at parts of society that would have produced laws that had to have some kind of legal customs and structures, or their society would have fallen apart, divided itself, and it's they consequently would have had to produce, maybe even without quite consciously doing it, a set of social customs that could have been a means then whereby they governed each other's behavior. And it would, in that situation, then a law is something that emerges somewhat unselfconsciously. Mm-hmm. But if it is effective in keeping social conflict from broadening, mm-hmm. and if then whatever system of judges there are can help those standards, those laws apply in very conflicted situations, then they obviously take on a role as being a precedent for new conflicts, conflicted stages like that. And so de facto, in my view, you have what is essentially a law. Mm-hmm. That is to say, it is something that is recognized by the community, it has some standing, judges are able to interpret it and apply it. There usually is some system of sanctions, punishments or rewards, mm-hmm. and they normally exist then over generations. So, serving then as and the function of a precedent. So those are several ingredients, I think, of law. And if you, as I said, if you start with that kind of assumption, then you're going quite a bit beyond what the biblical text is presenting. Mm-hmm. Biblical text presents proscriptions and affirmative laws or commandments, all that stem originally or immediately, according to the text, from God or through Moses or some other figure, and that's doesn't really take into consideration all of those factors as I described it. That's a religious or an ideological approach to it. I'm not saying that is not appropriate. I'm just saying let's look at it differently.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And in discussing the laws in ancient Israel, besides having perhaps a slightly different approach in terms of defining what you mean by law, you also have a, at least as far as I'm concerned, or as far as I know, a different approach in terms of taking seriously into account the contexts where these laws appeared. For example, you talk a lot about the village context, the city and state context, and the cultic context. How did you decide to approach laws in ancient Israel through looking at these various contexts?
If you start not with the text, mm-hmm. but with society, then the immediate question then is, so what are the social groupings, contexts? Mm-hmm. There's been a fair amount of work that's recently, especially led by archaeologists in recent decades, about villages. We don't know a lot about them, but clearly, between 80 and 90%, maybe sometimes 95% of the whole population lived in these tiny villages, yeah. averaging only 75 to 150 people. I mean, that's the absolute bulk of the society lived there. They're, by and large, illiterate. They're not producing the biblical laws, but they're surviving over centuries. Mm. The biblical texts, I think, probably came out of cities. So it's not that they didn't have laws there, they did. But that's what we have then preserved in the Hebrew Bible. So there are two settings right there. Mm-hmm. And there are probably also many laws, if you will, or legal structures in the cities that didn't even get retained in the Hebrew Bible. Mm. So I'm not saying that everything was retained there, but it was a selection. But we probably, by and large, don't know much of anything about the villages. Mm-hmm. So between those two, then, it seems to me that the villages need the most attention at this point. Can we figure out at all what was going on legally, judicially, in those contexts. So that was, that's that context, the village, and then the cities and state, and then the third one is the cult. And a substantial portion of the biblical laws that we have to do with cultic or religious matters. The last part of Exodus, a lot in Leviticus and other materials too, vast amounts of our cultic laws. So obviously the cult also generates, or somebody is generating cultic laws, and quite plausibly it is the cult, and probably the central cult, again, because they're the ones that can write. It's not cultic, non-professional cultic officials living out in the villages. I mean, those people are primarily the elders, or someone in a village that seems to have some is granted some kind of religious esteem as a leader. But the cultic laws that we have pretty much are from the cities or from the central state. So those are not the only three contexts that could have been producing them, but there are, I think, three prominent primary ones. And by looking at those three, at any rate, we have a chance to compare the settings against each other.
Mm-hmm. Behind what you've been saying, I think, is a picture of what ancient Israel's social structure looked like. And one of the resources that you use for describing that social structure is the work of Gerhard Lenski, and particularly his book Power and Privilege. And so I was wondering, who is Gerhard Lenski? How were you introduced to his work, and how do you find him to be particularly helpful in analyzing ancient Israelite society, as opposed to perhaps other people that theorize about social structure?
Yeah, he doesn't really deal all that much with ancient Israel. He does a lot with ancient societies and mm-hmm. other societies in Southwest Asia. But actually, Lenski ranges over the whole world and the whole of world history almost. He is what's considered a macro sociologist. Mm-hmm. And it's comparative work. It's got a fair amount similar with anthropology of law, but it's because of that comparative element. I really can't recall when I first came upon him. His book was first published in, I think it was 1966, and it's been reissued since then. When I first landed on it, it was probably in the 80s sometimes. I found it a very refreshing thing to read. I thought ancient Israel all over it, without its being mentioned, or mentioned much. And, of course, he does deal with some levels of society that would have preceded ancient Israel. So he deals with the hunting and gathering stages, for example. But this is this is the period now that he's referring to as an agrarian society, and the elements of it I thought fit really quite well with what we can imagine would have been the case in ancient Israel. I know quite a number of colleagues who think that it's not appropriate to take somebody's model and import it or apply it directly to ancient Israel. I think that we have to be very careful, and I have tried to be careful about that, so that it's to use it as a model really quite loosely, adjusting things in light of the ancient Israel system. But at least it's gives me a point of departure, and it's one that I think fits it. One of the basic principles that Lenski has is that there is a marked inequality of power and privilege. across the society of an agrarian state. And his title of his book is Power and Privilege. And it's and his and I think that probably that was the case also in ancient Israel. It was certainly the prophets go into great detail to indicate that there's oppression going on within their system, not just from another country oppressing them. And so that kind of inequality that exists is somewhat along the lines of the city and the village, that the city, most of the power is present in the cities, and they can do what they want to with the villagers because the villagers can't act together. However, within the village also, there are structures of power. There are certain individuals, adults rather than children, people in their prime of life rather than perhaps very elderly have more power. Males have more power than females. The head of a household has more power than everyone else in the household. So it's not as if it's an innocent place in the villages. It's a structure that you see running throughout the whole society. And in the same fashion, in terms of the cult, those who are part of the central cult will have the chance to try to steer the cultic behavior that's going on elsewhere in the country. They may not succeed, but they've got a military force behind them to back them up if they wanted to. Certainly, the sanction of the king. So it kind of gives us a starting point. That is Lenski's work gives a starting point. I think it should be combined with John Kowski's book,
The Politics of Aristocratic
Empires, which was written not long after Lenski's book. And the two of them together, I think, really provide a very nice picture of how things can function socially, politically, and economically in traditional societies.
You mentioned that some scholars, some of your colleagues, have some difficulties with taking something outside of the sphere of ancient Israel and applying it to try to understand that society. And I mean, another example would be another thing you use, critical legal studies. I could imagine that there would be some opposition to that. What is critical legal studies, and why do you use it?
You know, it's just kind of some of these eureka experiences that you have, I guess, in life. And one of the things, just like reading some the Lenski book, also reading some material on critical legal studies really was significant for me. It helped me get a better angle on law. Critical legal studies got going in the 1970s. And to a great extent, it was a follow-up on the turn of events socially and politically that began in the 1960s with the 60s generation. And I happen to be of the 60s generation, so I found what was going on then with critical legal studies to be really quite to my liking. And it was. It's also at that time that you've got feminism, including feminist legal studies, starting, and critical race theory, and concern about economic inequalities, classism, and so. So, critical legal studies was a movement that was based on the so-called legal realism that goes back to the 1920s or even before. They recognizes the fact that there are politics at work. Laws don't just make themselves, and neither then nor now. Just take a look at all of the money that's lavished through lobbyists on the legislators, and the legislators running for political office and political power. I mean, these are factors that affect the laws that are made. Why wouldn't that happen at any time in history? So, to my mind, critical legal studies is a major help in getting us to realize that laws are not necessarily pure and innocent, if you will. Mm-hmm. It's not much practice anymore, critical legal studies. Many of the people who were its advocates were quite, became activists, and that was apparently frowned on somewhat by other legal specialists. But on the other hand, in my mind, it's almost like the effect of feminism on a person. Once you've come to terms with what feminism is trying to say, it's hard to see the world without taking that into consideration. I mean, you've changed, and I think to some extent, critical legal studies actually had a similar effect on, more limited, a similar effect on legal theoreticians and sociologists. And, you know, well, of course there's politics involved in making a law. You know, many people then want to say, okay, well, now we've accepted that point. Let's go on and do and look at something further, you know. But still, so in many respects, I think that it's not that everybody agrees to it, but it's one of those things, well, of course, power reigns. You know, of course there's politics. Well, of course there's misogyny and androcentrism. And so, you know, well, these things then have become kind of part of now of how we are willing to and able to see the world. And we can't not see it those ways. Mm-hmm. So it's been very helpful to me. It does. One thing that it's done, I think, is it's made me suspicious. And it's with that notion of critical legal studies, I really can't look at a text anymore without wondering, so what's the motivation going on here? Are there some ulterior motives that are not being acknowledged in the text? Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean it's a cynical stance, but it means let's just not be naive.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Shifting back to your approach to the law collections to law in ancient Israel, shifting away from the theoretical to a degree, I wanted to ask a question about how you date the law collections in your book, which seems to be strikingly different from a lot of other scholarship on the collections. How are you approaching in relation to what has been done before? How are you approaching the dating of these collections?
The traditional dating among scholars has it that that there was a legal collection named the Covenantal Code, found in Exodus 21 to 23. That is probably the oldest collection of laws, and most people have thought that it should be dated to about the 10th or 9th century. And then after that was the Deuteronomic Code, Deuteronomy 12 through 26, which most people dated to the 7th century B.C. And then following that, or somewhere in there, would have been the Holiness Code in Leviticus, which most people would put in the 6th century. Some go down to the 5th, maybe, but everybody says, well, it includes laws that are older than that, so they may go back a couple centuries. And then the priestly code is about everything else. And that's usually dated to the 6th century, the 5th century BCE, also with, you know, people maintain that many of its laws also are older. Well, that's the conventional notion. So a 10th century, a 7th century, a 6th century, and 5th century. And to my mind, that's... that's all speculative. I'm engaging in a lot of speculation in this book. People take these notions about the antiquity of these laws and take them almost as a given, as a fact. It's not a fact. That's speculative work that's been done by scholars. And to my mind, laws didn't need to be written earlier on. If they were functioning, they didn't need to have literary form. Hardly anybody could read anyhow. Maybe only 1 to 2% of the total population was literate. So what good's it going to do to have them in written form? Even most of the people in the cities, maybe even couldn't read, and maybe even their king couldn't read. I mean, they didn't have to. If you the people who read and wrote were professional scribes. And if I'm a wealthy landowner and I have something that a deed that I want to have written, well, I would get the right kind of scribe to write out that deed. I don't do it myself. I mean, we still do this now. In fact, we go to professionals for it. So what this is meaning is that the written form of these collections is, I think, that is a wrong way to begin. I think that probably we need to understand these laws as functioning laws and to try to imagine the periods in which they could have come into existence and functioned, and they would have been passed on orally, or there could have been some materials that have been written down that would were passed on. But by and large, they were in oral form as long as they were valid terms according to which people handled disputes or claims in their society. So in that case, I think that the written laws would not have come down and wouldn't have happened until much later. And I think that all of the written laws, actually the written collections, happened after the exile, during the Persian period. And it's a I'm not saying that this is the case, but it's tantalizing to bring this into conjunction with one text that we have from the Persian king Darius that seems to be is probably dated from around, they're referring to an event around 518 BCE. When he sent a note to the Egyptians and asked them to record the laws of the Pharaoh, the laws of the temple, and the laws of the people. Now, if you take those three rubrics, Pharaoh, so the king, the temple, and the people, you have essentially the three collections that we've got in the Hebrew Bible, the people being the covenant code, temple being all the religious laws, and the king being the laws of the state and the city, which primarily what you have in Deuteronomy. Now, I don't think that fits quite perfectly well, but it's close, and it's certainly indicates to me, to my mind, what could have been an initial trigger for writing down laws. If Darius demanded it of Egypt, he could have demanded it of all other Persian provinces, including Yehud, Judea. Mm-hmm. And then the laws, you know, people, probably the elite, would have delivered to him some laws that were satisfied those three groupings. And that may have been the first time anybody ever thought to write down laws. I think those were not necessarily the laws that we've got in the Hebrew Bible. I think they were not the laws that were in the Hebrew Bible. It may have taken another century or two before people then started having that precedent of some legal materials in writing, then started to go ahead and write them up and redact them and deliver them finally to the form that they've got in the Hebrew Bible. So it's a, you know, that's a long answer to your question, but I think the dating I think it makes more sense to date all the writing of all these laws into the Persian period rather than the earlier monarchy.
You've talked a number of times about, and you talk quite extensively in the book, about the distinction between the laws that we have in the Bible and ancient Israelite law. And you've talked about the biblical laws possibly being a selection of those laws, but I was wondering, but you also seem to be a little bit skeptical about, or at least that was my reading of your book, a little bit skeptical about how much you can work with the biblical laws in understanding ancient Israelite law. Can and how do you use laws that, as you say in the book, are embedded in these narratives to understand ancient Israelite law? I mean, what's the connection?
Well, I think that they are connected. It's just a question of where you start. And if you start with the texts, then that's going to affect what kind of society you think existed back then.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I wanted to reverse it.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of, for the moment, let's forget about what's in the Hebrew Bible. Let's try to figure out on the best basis of archaeological findings and sociological theory and other textual evidence from ancient Southwest Asia. Let's try to figure out what those societies were like in ancient Israel, the various social settings. And then the next question was, so what kind of legal conflicts could they have had?
Hmm.
If they had a legal conflict over, say, whose land this is, or what do we do in the case of personal injury, however they resolve that, then that becomes then a precedent, which then is in effect then becomes a law or a legal custom. So is that the Bible? Is that the biblical material? Some of that could have ended up in the biblical text. But as soon as you figure in the issue of power and the probable factual existence of social and economic inequalities, then whatever ends up in writing may also be affected by those other factors of power and inequality, so they may not then conform fully with what was functioning in ancient Israel. So that's why I try to distinguish at the beginning of the book between Israelite laws and biblical laws. And it's just kind of a heuristic device. The biblical laws are just that, the things that are in the text. And those are literature. They're not necessarily laws that ever functioned. Right now, they've come to us as literature. Israelite laws are the laws that we're speculating about. We're trying to figure out what kind of legal controls would have been necessary for those societies to have existed. And the biblical laws, I draw on them a fair amount, but I'm not primarily interested in exegeting or describing the laws of the Bible, the Hebrew Bible. So the quote that you began with, for example, that's not my agenda. Somebody else is welcome to do it, but I just wanted to try a different end run on it.
And more than half of your book is associated with, the latter half of the book is associated with reconstructing these laws as they appeared in villages, as they appeared in the cities and the states, as they appeared in the cult. I just want to make sure this is a fair summary. In each chapter, you seem to start off with reconstructing the material settings of the various contexts, and then you talk about what kinds of laws might have appeared in those contexts. Is that
right.
Fair? That's
yes.
A fair summary. Okay. We don't have time to go into this section in any kind of detail, but I did have a few questions that I wanted to ask you about them. So they might seem kind of random, but
that's fine.
They interested me. One question that I had, I was struck when I was reading about the section on cultic laws, what seemed to be the relative lack of influence of the national cult on the villages. It seemed like the urban population, or at least the urban population that went to the temple, and I don't know what percentage that would be, were under certain cultic obligations, but they didn't seem to extend to anybody else. Is that a fair reading of what you're talking about there?
Well, you know, I think that's fair. I think I'd add a couple of points to it. The central cult is situated, of course, in the capital city, mm-hmm. either Jerusalem or Samaria in the north, and that's where the temple is. But there are also other cities during the monarchic period. Some of them called royal cities. There are not a lot of people in them, but that's where really the king's power is also based. And some of those might have had also some smaller temples or some other cultic site. And it's possible that there was a professional priesthood that was there also. Now, I don't know whether we should see, to what extent we can see that whole system as a closed entity. Did the high priests and the powerful priests in Jerusalem or Samaria decide who was going to be priest in these royal cities? Maybe to some extent. Were they able to control everything that was done in those cities? Probably not. So, but they may have tried to have some control over them. But it was possible throughout the region, throughout the country, that up in Hatzor, up in the north, way in the north, I mean, the capital city couldn't necessarily keep an eye on what was going on there. So there could have been some of their own traditions that developed there. And sure enough, the prophets point out that, as a matter of fact, there's a lot of wayward practices that are emerging throughout the countryside. So there could be the more control there, though, between the central priesthood in the capital cities and some of the primary powerful cities around. Not full, but more control. However, you get to the villages, and there I think they lose control. How in the world are they going to be able to control hundreds of villages, maybe in size, like I said, 75 to 150 people, but some of them smaller than 75? How are they going to be able to control their religious practices, the cultic practices in all of those places? There is no internet system where they can send out notices about what to do this next Sabbath. And they have no means of checking to be certain that sacrifices are going to be done the same everywhere, much less that religious beliefs are the same everywhere. So there's a lot more autonomy when you go out to the villages. And remember, as I said, that's somewhere between 80 and 95% of the whole population. Yeah. So the masses among the Israelites were pretty much on their own. The capital city, the capital cities and their centralized cults may have wanted to control them, but I just do not see how they could have. Hmm. So, and again, sure enough, the prophets are not, also in the time of Josiah, at the end of the 7th century, you know, there's the text talking about tearing down all the cultic sites, all the altars and shrines and everywhere else in the country. So I mean, obviously that's something I think is very plausible. Mm-hmm. And that's you would think that would be evidence of the lack of control of the central priesthood. Mm-hmm. Frankly, mm-hmm. which I think fits the social model that I was working with.
Okay. You in the chapters that on villages and cities and states, you categorize the types of laws into social laws and economic laws, and then you discuss various law, reconstruct various laws in those categories. One question that I had as I was reading these chapters, were there also political laws? I mean, were they a couple of maybe unusual political laws that I was thinking about were things like laws against treason or laws against rebellion against the ruler. I mean, were there laws for these kinds of things, as far as you can tell in a reconstruction?
Probably. I think that there have been laws from the monarchy out. Was there a system, a countrywide political system or structure of expectations and regulations? I didn't mean, when I was focusing my discussions there on social laws and economic laws, I wasn't suggesting that that's all there were. It's just that I kind of ran out of energy. I really seriously thought about doing a section on political. I have an article that I'd written earlier on politics and power in monarchic Israel, which I do deal with some of that, and it's a this is not an exclusive or a total picture that I'm providing here. This is kind of going to be more a sampling. But the politics again. See, for example, Darius, the Persian king, clearly had some empire-wide law, and it was so he would have wanted from Egypt and from Israel or from anybody else their local laws, which he then combined then with the law of the empire. And the law of the empire would have to do with primarily state issues, interests. So there's a, you know, and I can imagine during the monarchic Israel that the king would have had certain laws that are, or certain, or regulations, policies that ensured the interests of the crown. That's political, you know. Also within villages, as I said, there are power imbalances, so there could be some political angles there too. Now, I think it's very much that politics plays a major role throughout all of this.
Right. And I think this is the last question I have about this larger section of your book, and this is focused on your discussion of responsibilities, laws about responsibilities toward the vulnerable. In your chapter on laws in the cities and the state, you question the likelihood that laws on behalf of the poor, and some of those laws would include things like remission of debts, manumission of slaves, restoration of ancestral land. You question whether these were ever really enforced, and there are other folks who have questioned this as well, largely because such enforcement wouldn't be sustainable economically for the elites. Yet, obviously, such laws are in the Bible, and you suggest that the drafting of those laws came at the direction of the elites in the cities. Further, you suggest that perhaps these laws serve the function of quote, manipulating the poor in the country, unquote, that the elites, quote, attempted to convince the masses that relief was imminent if they fell on hard times, unquote. So my question had to do with what the mechanism was by which this manipulation occurred. That is, what were the ways by which what was communicated in these texts what was communicated in these texts was shared with the poor. I mean, how did the poor How were the poor manipulated? What was the material?
Good. This is one of the more sensitive parts, I think, of my book and my argument. I'm not entirely convinced myself, but pretty much so. I've always maintained that the laws of release, the release from slavery every seventh year, the release of debts, the return of ancestral land if you've fallen on hard times, that those are some of the highest ethical statements in our history, I think. I mean, they pronounce an extraordinarily high ethic. But you've got to ask, so did it work? That's why I meant that if those were applied, just imagine that in our own context, every 7 years, all loans are wiped out. And if you had to be your house foreclosed on, which has now happened to God knows how many people, well, at the Jubilee year, which is the 49th or the 50th year, that land is going to be returned to you or to your descendants. An economy could not manage. Mm. It just flat out could not handle that. And sure enough, for the prominence that these laws are given, there's scarcely ever any evidence that they were applied. Mm. There's some slight allusions to them. There are also, this is not only Israel that had release laws like this. They're also known from other countries, cultures in this area, going way back, in fact, millennium. And when usually it was a king who would come to the throne and become king, and would maybe his first pronouncement would be, to release all slaves. And then a year later, everybody could, then he would cancel that. So the slaves would all have to go back to the original masters. But in the meantime, he's gotten probably the masses to believe that he's going to be their advocate. Mm-hmm. And then he reverses it, and then he's got the elite in his corner. So it's, and that's cynical, realistic is what I would say. I think that they would be if you're going to be realistic about this, I just can't quite see how those laws would have been able to have been practiced on a regular basis. So why are they there? To my mind, they're there for two reasons. Number one, because they do pronounce a real desire or wish among the peasants, the people who are in extreme situations, in poverty, loss of land, loss of wherewithal of life, livelihoods. They would dream of a chance when they would be restored. So that I can see realistically how that would exist as a desire or goal or an ideal among those who are powerless. But I can also see, and this is the second aspect, how then those who do have the power could take that dream or that wish, that longing, and try to capitalize on it, and perhaps hold out some chance for release, but then not deliver on it, and in the process, then have been able to get the poor laborers and landless people to do their bidding for some for few further years, and then we can't manage this 77th year. We'll do the next 7th year or something, and so you get them further. And that, see, I mean, it's just, I think that it's a way of exploiting those who are powerless. Yeah. So it's, you know, I think it is a legitimate and real desire among those who need it that could be capitalized on by those who have the power to do that. So that's kind of, so why are they there in the text? Well, who wrote the text? The people who were powerful. But they were not necessarily compelling themselves to abide by them.
And that, I think, brings me to the final question, which, given all of this, all of this relationship between the powerful and the powerless in ancient Israel, given the exploitation and oppression that's going on, was there justice in ancient Israel? I mean, justice is part of the title of your book, and I have to say, after reading it, I was a little bit unclear about where the justice came in, other than these ideals that you talked about. So can you identify any spots of justice?
Oh, no, yes, I can, I think. Or at least I think that it was, justice was often frustrated, but it was probably sought after and probably achieved in many of the among the peasants in the villages, again, where the masses lived. I think that they probably were more able to, I mean, in times of famine, everyone in a village hungered. When they had a good harvest, everyone benefited from it. You know, it was, I can't imagine, and this, there's no evidence for this, but it's, I can't imagine that there would be one person who would, in a village, who would be able to gorge himself or herself while everybody else around them, all their other relatives, the clan members, starved. I mean, I think that there was a certain leveling principle there, and it's a, and there is, I think, a certain sense of the common good, to use our modern term, that was prevalent there. So, but the other thing is, I think that it's a, it does help us from our perspective read this material with some suspicion, not necessarily accepting it on face value, trying to understand ways in which the laws might have benefited certain groups or individuals and not others. I think that's always a question that's worth asking. And it's a, this is part of the theology of liberation as well. Mm-hmm. And it's a liberation ethics. It's very much concerned about the inappropriate spread of benefits and costs in a society. And it's a, so, I think that if we read the biblical laws with some of these sensitivities in mind, we're going to be able to see some of their problems, not simply accept them all at face value. And perhaps function with more sensitivity and suspicion in our own world, because that's going on all the time for us too. And it's I would not want to idealize ancient Israel any more than I'd want to idealize the United States. You know, we always have to remain alert for in our own context. And remain alert about what's going on in our ancient heritage.
Doug, thank you again for this conversation. Again, I've been talking with Doug Knight, author of the forthcoming book, Law, Power, and Justice in Ancient Israel, soon to appear from Westminster John Knox Press as part of the Library of Ancient Israel series. And if you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Contact Us link at the bottom of the page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks again for listening.
Thank you, Grace.